Welcome to the Enduring Word Podcast. Enduring Word is a free online Bible commentary written by Pastor David Guzik and is used daily as a trusted resource for millions of believers around the world. We are honored to present the wisdom of the Bible to you, one chapter and verse at a time, to help you grow in your understanding of God's Word. Today we come to the final chapter of the wisdom-filled book of Proverbs. Pastor David Guzik will guide us verse by verse through Proverbs chapter 31, a chapter attributed to King Lemuel's mother. We find a striking example of a wise and God-fearing woman who points her son and her readers to the wisdom and strength of godly living.
How do you find an excellent woman? That's a question that a lot of men have asked through the centuries. And women have also wanted a measure by which they can evaluate themselves to see if they fit that standard of an excellent woman. Proverbs chapter 31 contains one of the best guides to finding an excellent woman and how to measure or evaluate whether or not a woman is excellent. It's the one of the best passages in the entire Bible having to deal with that. We'll get to that in a moment, because it's the second half of this wonderful chapter, Proverbs chapter 31, that gives us wisdom from King Lemuel. Let's take a look here, starting at verse 1, Proverbs chapter 31. The words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. Now, as with Agur in Proverbs chapter 30, we don't know anything about King Lemuel. He's not in any recorded list of the kings of Judah or Israel. So he was probably a pagan king who put his trust in Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. And through the fear of the Lord, King Lemuel learned wisdom. Now, the name Lemuel means belonging to God. And as I said before, there was no king of Israel or Judah with this name. So he could have been a foreign king, or Lemuel could simply be a pen name for the author. Several older commentators and some Jewish legends say that Lemuel, that name meaning the one belonging to God, was Solomon himself. And the mother mentioned here in verse 1 was Bathsheba. But there's really no evidence for this. G. Campbell Morgan said this. He said, there's been many conjectures as to who King Lemuel was, but nothing certainly can be said. And then Adam Clark added on to this. He said, there is no evidence whatever that Muel or Lemuel means Solomon. If Agur was not the author of it, it may be considered as another supplement to the book of Proverbs. And then Adam Clark adds this, most certainly Solomon did not write this. But whoever wrote this, he understood that he was bringing forth the word of God. That's why it says there in verse 1, the words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. Like Solomon, that's back in Proverbs chapter 2, verse 6, and like Agur, that's in Proverbs chapter 30, verse 1, Lemuel understood that his words were an utterance, a prophecy, or a revelation from God. But verse 1 also tells us that this was wisdom which his mother taught him. We could say that Proverbs chapter 31 gives us the wisdom of Lemuel, and that's true. But it's really wisdom that his mother taught him. It's the wisdom of Lemuel's mother given to us from Lemuel. And so perhaps like Timothy, you can find a reference to that in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5. Lemuel had a mother who taught him the fear of the Lord and God's wisdom. So with that introduction here in verse 1, let's take a look starting now at verses 2 and 3, warning a son of the danger of sexual immorality. Again, this is wisdom given to us from King Lemuel, but remember, it's the wisdom that he learned from his mother. Starting now at verse 2. What, my son? And what, son of my womb? And what, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. Notice here the preface in verse 2, where Lemuel's mother speaks to him and says, my son, son of my womb, son of my vows. King Lemuel's mother spoke to him with great tenderness, describing her connection with him in three ways. He was her son, but then he was also the son of her womb, having given birth to him. And finally, he was the son of her vows, her promises and commitments. She is pressing upon him the seriousness of what she's going to say by appealing to this deep relationship that she has with him. And this is the warning in verse 3, do not give your strength to women. The sense is that an excessive sexual interest in women will waste a man's strength. This speaks of an unhealthy obsession with romance or sex, which may have a proper place in life, but should not be made into a reason for living. The practice of sexual immorality and sex obsession, no matter what form it may take, gives away a man's strength in the sense of his spiritual strength, in the sense of his self-respect, in the sense of his self-control, and in the sense of his example and standing in the community. Dear brother, don't give away your strength like that. Now, it could also be rightly said that sexual immorality and sex obsession in a woman gives away her strength as well. But King Lemuel's mother spoke this to her son. She wasn't speaking to her daughter. In other words, both men and women need to remain faithful to God in regard to sex and romance, or they will give away their strength. But since this advice is coming from a mother to her son, the focus here is what he puts on giving away your strength to a woman. Alan Ross puts it like this. The point of the verse is that while it would be easy for a king to spend his time and energy enjoying women, that would be unwise. Well, I agree with Alan Ross on that, and I would say it would be a waste. And then the second line of verse 3 takes the thought a little deeper. She says, nor give your ways to that which destroys kings. Now, when we connect this with the previous line, it seems that Lemuel's mother warned him and warns us all against sexual and romantic obsession, something so powerful that it destroys kings, even the greatest of kings. Now, you know that the book of Proverbs is predominantly the work of King Solomon. The first 29 chapters contain Solomon's Proverbs. Chapter 30, the Proverbs of King Agur. Chapter 31, this Proverbs of King Lemuel. But it's predominantly the work of King Solomon. But King Solomon, tragically, was a man who himself was destroyed as he gave his strength to women, just as verse 3 warns against. If you want a description of that, look up 1 Kings chapter 11, the first 10 verses of that chapter. It describes how Solomon became unfaithful to the Lord and turned away from Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, because his attraction to foreign women turned his heart away from the Lord and introduced tremendous idolatry into his own life. There's a real sense in which Solomon disobeyed this command. He, even being a great king, destroyed himself by giving his strength to women. But that's not the only thing. Solomon's father, King David, also suffered tragically when he gave his strength to women. You can look that up in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. Bruce Waltke put it like this. Obsession with such women corrupts the king's sovereign power. David's lust for Bathsheba made him callous towards justice and cost Uriah his life. And Solomon's many sexual partners made him callous towards pure and undefiled religion and incapable of real love. In other words, obsession with women has the same effect as obsession with liquor. That was the great warning to King Lemuel from his mother. Friend, it's a warning that we need to take seriously today, especially with the preponderance of sexual obsession presented to us in the society. We see it on every front, in every form of media. People simply obsessed with sex. And friends, this is, in the case of a man, giving away your strength to women. And it has been the ruin of many kings. What makes you think you will stand if you give your strength away in such a manner? Now, starting at verse 4, we're going to have four verses that speak to us, warning a son of the danger of alcohol. Here continues the wisdom of King Lemuel's mother. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Verse 4, in its plain, straightforward statement, it is not for kings to drink wine, tells us that kings and those who lead should avoid alcohol and other intoxicants. Verse 4 says, intoxicating drink. This would cover more than strictly alcohol, but those who use drugs recreational, I think, would fall into the same category. Kings and those who lead should not avoid, or should avoid, I should say, alcohol and intoxicating things. Now, the idea here in these verses is repeated three times for emphasis. And I want to be honest with you as a Bible teacher and a Bible student. The Bible does see a potential blessing in wine. It makes the heart merry. It lightens the heart. There is a potential blessing in wine, yet it is a dangerous blessing that must be carefully regarded. And for many people, such as kings and leaders, it should be voluntarily set aside. According to John Trapp, at times, this principle was taken very seriously in the ancient world. This is what John Trapp wrote in his commentary. He said, the Carthaginians made a law that no magistrate of theirs should drink wine. The Persians permitted their kings to be drunk one day in a year only. And Solon had made a law at Athens that drunkenness in a prince should be punished with death. So this idea that it was not appropriate for a king to get caught up in drunkenness and drinking was known in the ancient world. And King Lemuel's mother will continue and explain here in verse 5, lest they drink and forget the law. The responsibilities of a king are so great that it is essential that he not be impaired in his judgment or his abilities in any way. Now, this principle is true not only for kings, but for leaders of many types, including and especially those who consider themselves leaders among God's people today. Look, I know that in recent decades, it's become much more fashionable for Christians to drink alcohol. And this is sometimes reflected by Christian leaders who themselves believe they have a great liberty to drink alcohol. Tread carefully, my friend. Tread carefully, dear brother, pastor, or elder, or leader among God's people. Take this warning from Proverbs chapter 31 seriously. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law. If they forget God's word or their application of the law, and they may even, as it says here in verse 5, pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Matthew Poole said of this, he said, it may easily be done by a drunken judge because drunkenness deprives a man of the use of reason. by which alone men can distinguish between right and wrong. Dear leader who feels this great liberty to consume alcohol and perhaps even to catch a buzz off of the drinking that you do, you're charged with making decisions that affect the people of God. Can you have your senses, your reason impaired in such a way? No, instead, look at what it says here in verse 6. Give strong drink to him who is perishing. King Lemuel's mother thought of two more appropriate drinkers rather than the king or the leader. First, she thought of the condemned criminal who needs to be numbed by strong drink on his way to execution. That's why she says, verse 6, give strong drink to him who is perishing. But then secondly, she thought of those who are bitter of heart. And as it says in verse 7, drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Now look, it isn't that there are no consequences for drinking in these two cases, but rather that the consequences have little impact in comparison to the king or the leader. This is telling us something, that whatever rules there may be for Christian liberty regarding the consumption of intoxicants for believers in general, it's a different standard for those who would be leaders among the people of God. Adam Clark put it like this: we have already seen that inebriating drinks were mercifully given to condemned criminals to render them less sensible of the torture they endured in dying. This is what was offered to our Lord, but he refused it. And then it's also important to say that just because the Queen Mother said, the mother of King Lemuel, that it was more appropriate for those condemned to die and those who were filled with bitterness of soul to drink, it's important that we understand this that Duane Garrett said in his commentary. He said, the Queen Mother does not recommend a free beer program for the poor or justify its use as an opiate for the masses. Her point is simply that the king must avoid drunkenness in order to reign properly. And friends, that's very true. But look at there, one of the last lines in verse 7. It says there, and remember his misery no more. That's what would happen with the consumption of alcohol, either with the condemned criminal or the man who was bitter of soul. You see, King Lemuel's mother understood that strong drink, that wine, and that other intoxicants take away from a person's performance and excellence. He'll remember his misery no more. Why? Well, because he's somewhat not in his own clear mind. And because strong drink, wine, and other intoxicants take away from a person's performance and excellence, for this and for other reasons, many people, especially those people in leadership, should avoid alcohol altogether. Let me say one more thing about this before we move on to verses 8 and 9. It's a statement that Charles Spurgeon said about this idea, and remember his misery no more, that I can't pass up. Spurgeon said this, quote, if any man should be wicked enough to draw from it the inference that he would be able to forget his misery and poverty by drinking, he would soon find himself woefully mistaken. For if he had one misery before, he would have 10 miseries afterwards. And if he was previously poor, he would be in still greater poverty afterwards. Those who fly to the bottle for consolation might as soon fly to hell to find a heaven. And instead of helping them to forget their poverty, drunkenness would only sink them still more deeply in the mire. Look, King Lemuel's mother was wise. She knew that alcohol has a stupefying effect on people, as well as do other intoxicants. And she realized that many people flee to alcohol and other intoxicants because of this stupefying effect. It makes them forget their problems, but it does nothing to solve their problems. Instead, their problems just become worse. You come out of your drunken stupor or your intoxicated condition, and things are only worse. They're not any better. Friends, take this warning of King Lemuel that he received from his mother very seriously. Now, continuing on, verses 8 and 9, where the wisdom is about defending the defenseless, we read, "Open your mouth for the speechless. In the cause of all who are appointed to die, open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy." The idea is that there are those who can't speak for themselves, to defend themselves, especially in a court of law, or perhaps also in less formal circumstances. The wise and godly man or woman will speak for the speechless and take up the cause of the defenseless, those who are appointed to die. There are people who, in our modern age, apply these verses and this wisdom to the cause of the unborn in their anti-abortion activism. And I think it's an appropriate application of the principle of these verses. Who is less speechless than the child in the womb? Who is more appointed to die than the child who's targeted for an abortion? And so it's right. It's right to open your mouth for the speechless. It's a right to take up the cause of those who are appointed to die. Now, it's very interesting. As a unit, these first nine verses of Proverbs chapter 31 raise an important question. If you're a leader, you'll have some position of power, some level of prestige. Are you going to use it to indulge yourself with women and wine, or will you use your position and your power to protect and benefit those you lead? Especially those who are speechless and those who are unjustly appointed to die. Here, the counsel is clear. Verse 9 says, "Open your mouth, judge righteously." Now, this was especially important for a king like Lemuel, but it applies to everyone. If we have the opportunity to right a wrong, or if we see that a wrong is punished, then we should speak up, that is, open your mouth, and we should speak righteously. We should, as verse 9 says, plead the cause of the poor and needy who have trouble properly defending themselves. Now, it's interesting that this is the focus of King Lemuel's mother in her advice to her king son. Open your mouth as a speechless, for the cause of all those appointed to die, open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy. Dwayne Garrett makes this, I think, valid observation. It is noteworthy that this is her sole political concern. She doesn't say anything about building up the treasury, creating monuments to his reign, or establishing a dominant military power. For her, the king's throne is truly founded on righteousness. This is good advice for a king, again, given to us in the writings of King Lemuel, but what he received from his mother. Now, starting at verse 10, and going on for the next 22 verses till the end of Proverbs chapter 31 and the end of the book of Proverbs, we have some interesting introductory material to note about this section. First of all, I want to note that this section was unique in my own preparation for it. These teachings that I'm doing for you right now come from the material from my verse-by-verse teaching and commentary through the entire Bible. And when I set out to create this commentary, to create these teaching notes on the books of the Bible, I did it as it would suit my congregation in the teaching and preaching ministry that I've done for my congregation. Well, one thing that I have never done before was taught through the book of Proverbs for a congregation. I'm very pleased to be doing it now for you and whoever else would listen. But all that to say this, in the preparation of this commentary, these teaching notes, the book of Proverbs was the last one of all the 66 books of the Bible that I prepared. The book of Proverbs was a little bit intimidating to me as a Bible commentator. It was intimidating because of its lack of structure, its lack of context from verse to verse. Now, I'm so pleased that I've been able to teach through this for 31 chapters here for you and for whoever else would listen. But I just want to explain that in this last chapter of this last book, I did something in the preparation for it that I'd never done before. I really consulted my wife in this section from 10 to verse 31 that speaks of the excellent woman, the excellent wife. My wife Ingalill's input and help was a valuable collaboration on this portion of the commentary. So that's one thing to say. Here's the second thing to say. The 22 verses from here to the end of the book of Proverbs each begin with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. There's 22 letters in the biblical Hebrew alphabet. Now, this acrostic construction, where each verse begins with a successive letter of the alphabet, that acrostic construction was used in several Psalms. Psalms 9 and 10, Psalm 25, Psalm 34, Psalm 37, Psalm 111, Psalm 112, Psalm 119, Psalm 145. And it's also found in Lamentations chapter 4. The purpose of this was to make the passage memorable, that is, easier to memorize, but it was also in order to express poetic skill. And it is skillful. Derek Kidner called this section of Proverbs chapter 31 an alphabet of wifely excellence. And this acrostic arrangement made memorization easier and perhaps also served to organize the author's thoughts. And so what we have here is sort of a from A to Z, we would say it with our alphabet, about the excellent woman, the excellent wife. So let's go into this wonderful section, starting here at verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. In this last section of Proverbs chapter 31, these are the words of Lemuel's mother. Please remember that. These are the words of Lemuel's mother spoken to him about the qualities of a virtuous wife. The following verses speak of her character and her activity. This gives Lemuel an idea of the kind of woman that he should search for and that he should prize. Now, this passage is traditionally understood as being addressed to women, but it is more accurately spoken by a woman to a man, King Lemuel, so that he could know the character and potential character of a good wife before marriage, and so that he could value and praise his wife for her virtuous character once he was married. You could say that it is primarily a search list for a man, and it is only secondarily a checklist for a woman. Now, I'm not saying that it's totally out of line to understand this as a checklist, to go through this section in Proverbs chapter 31 and see what it says about the excellent, virtuous woman and to say, well, hey, women, you should aspire to this. That's fine. But understand that first and foremost, it was a search list for King Lemuel, so that he would understand the character and the nature of an excellent wife or potential wife. You see, this passage describes the kind of wife that the Christian man should pray for and seek after. This passage gives a guide, a goal for the Christian woman, showing the kind of character that she can have as she fears and follows the Lord. And this passage also reminds the Christian man that he must walk in the fear and in the wisdom of God, so that he will be worthy of such a virtuous woman and compatible with such a virtuous woman. Look, I know a lot of men who would read this list and say, yes, that's the woman I want. And who wouldn't want this kind of woman? I have a woman who is largely characterized by the examples and by the nature described in these verses. My own wife, Inga Lil, is a virtuous wife, an excellent woman. There's no doubt about that. But friends, there's a responsibility on the side of the man. You've got to be compatible with such a woman. You need to be an excellent man and virtuous in your own way. So maybe this list isn't your list in that same proper way, but it affects you. And it should make you aspire to being a godly man of wisdom who truly fears the Lord. Now, verse 10 also says, who can find what? A virtuous wife. She is called a virtuous wife, not because only married women can have these qualities. I suppose a single woman could have these qualities as well. But because this is marriage guidance from a mother to a son. Remember, this is the word from King Lemuel's mother to her son, telling him this is the kind of woman to look for. The virtuous woman can be single or married, but each will have particular ways that virtue is expressed in their life, whether it's in their singleness or as a family. Bruce Waltke calls this woman not the virtuous wife, but the valiant wife. And he notes that the phrase Eseth Chayil, virtuous wife here, is translated as the excellent wife back in Proverbs chapter 12, verse 4. The term Eseth Chayil is also applied to men, and it's translated mighty men of valor in 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 14. It's translated competent men in Genesis chapter 47, verse 6, and able men in Exodus chapter 18, verse 21. Alan Ross had a good idea here. He said, the vocabulary and the expressions in general have the ring of an ode to a champion. Now, we think of a champion often as a warrior, someone who's victorious on the field of battle. Well, by analogy, even though women did not often fight in the armies of ancient Israel, if the women were fighting, it was an absolute desperate state. So it's not so much having the idea that this woman is a soldier, but rather that she's won a battle. She's fought a victory. You could put it like this. What this woman has did not simply fall to her. It is her victory through wisdom, her hard-won reward. Look, I think it would be easy for a woman to say, you look at the list as we're going to take a look at in just a moment, and the woman says, well, easy for her, that's her personality. And look, we know that some people just kind of match this more by their personality than others. But this isn't just something that fell to her. No, she won this through wisdom, through self-denial, through the fear of the Lord. Matter of fact, there's many allusions here to battle or to military ideas in this section. Let me give you some of the allusions here. First of all, as I said before, the phrase virtuous wife in verse 10 is the same expression that's translated mighty men of valor in Judges, such as in Judges chapter 6, verse 12. Secondly, the word strength in verse 17 is used in other places for great and heroic victories, such as Exodus chapter 15, verse 2 and 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 10. The word gain in verse 11 is actually the word for plunder, as in Isaiah chapter 8, verse 1 and verse 3 of Isaiah chapter 8. In other words, that which is gained through the effort of a battle. And then finally, the expression excel them all in verse 29 is an expression that signifies victory, usually military victory, at least according to Alan Ross in his commentary. So there's a lot of allusions here to battle, to warfare, to this woman as a champion. Again, not because it was the normal practice at all for women to fight in the armies of ancient Israel. It just wasn't the case. But what she has here, who she is, this is a hard-fought victory. It just didn't, to use an expression, fall into her lap. Now, the qualities of this virtuous wife, as described here in verses 11 through 31, these same qualities are often mentioned in previous Proverbs. You see, as a whole, the Proverbs have a lot to say about wisdom, about a diligent work ethic, about wise business practices, about honorable speech, about compassion for the poor, and about integrity. And these same qualities are explained here in connection to a virtuous wife. You could say that coming at the very end of the collection of Proverbs, you might say that this is a strong woman and her greatest strength is her wisdom, rooted in the fear of the Lord. She lives out the wisdom that we've seen in the rest of the book of Proverbs. So again, going back, we haven't gotten very far in this description, but I'll read verse 10 again. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. Precious gems like rubies are both valued and they are rare. In a sense, the complete profile of the Proverbs 31 woman is an ideal goal, much as the listing of the character of the godly man for leadership, both in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in Titus chapter 1. It would be rare, like a precious ruby, it would be rare to find a woman who excels in every aspect of this list. So, this list should not be used to compare or to condemn either one's self or another woman. I could see a woman using this list and falling into great condemnation of herself, or using it in a very harsh way to judge other women. But rather, I would say, this character should reflect the values and the aspirations of the woman who walks in the fear of the Lord and in godly wisdom. You see, her worth is far above rubies. The woman that's described in the rest of this chapter is rare and valuable, but her value, her worth, is greater than what she does, as explained in the following verses. Her value or her worth should not be reduced to the performance of these qualities. You see, she will be virtuous in her character before she acts in a virtuous manner. First, she is this virtuous woman, and then it is played out in the way that she acts. All right, all that, verse 10 is sort of an introduction here. Let's take a look at verses 11 and 12, which describe this excellent woman's, this virtuous woman's relationship with her husband. Verses 11 and 12. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. The virtuous wife not only has the trust of her husband, but it is safely given to her. Notice that phrasing in verse 11. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. I suppose that there's some men who unwisely trust some women. That's not what's being spoken about here. This is safely trusting. You see, her character is trustworthy. She's filled with integrity. She will speak, act, and live with wisdom, and therefore God's blessing will be on their home. Verse 11 says, he will have no lack of gain. A foolish woman who can't be trusted takes some measure of blessing away from the home. And this is often seen financially or materially. Look, my wife, Ingalil, she fits the characteristic of this verse. She's a trusted woman. One way that I can trust my wife, it's by no means the only way that I can trust her, but it's one of many ways. I can trust her with our bank account. She's not going to run out and spend money indulgently or foolishly. No, no, no. She can be trusted. She can be trusted on many different levels. F.B. Meyer described this fact of being able to trust the wife safely. He put it like this. But in whole delineation, there is hardly any trait more beautiful than this: absolute trustworthiness. He seeks her confidence and advice. He has no fear of her betraying his secrets. He can safely trust her. Or as John Trapp put it, he said, he is confident of her love, care, and fidelity. He dare trust her with his soul secrets and so forth. He doubteth not of her chastity, secrecy, or care to keep his family. He trusts her. You know, Martin Luther had something to say about his dear wife, Katie. Of Katie von Bora, his wife, he said this: the greatest gift of God is a pious, amiable spouse who fears God and loves his house and with whom one can live with in perfect confidence. What a blessing it is. And that blessing, one way it will be manifested in the home, is described for us in verse 11, where it says, he will have no lack of gain. You know, there are some people who think that a wife is a burden or a hindrance to gain into a better life. This is not so in God's plan. And with the presence and the influence of a virtuous wife, she brings gain to her husband on many levels and in great measure. He will have no lack of gain. Now, again, according to Alan Ross, gain here is a word that in Hebrew usually means plunder. And the point may be that the gain will be as rich and bountiful as the spoils of war. The bottom line in relation to her husband here in verse 12 is that she does him good and not evil. Now, there were several previous proverbs in the book of Proverbs that explained the bad effect of a bad wife. You know, it's better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a contentious woman. Proverbs like that. But the opposite is also true. A virtuous wife does her husband good and not evil. And she continues being a blessing all the days of her life. The sense is that her goodness and faithful character becomes deeper and greater through the passing years. Now, starting at verse 13, a section that describes her work and ingenuity. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. Using these wonderful poetic images, King Lemuel's mother described not the resume of a godly woman, but lifelike examples of the busy, hardworking, and creative character of the virtuous wife. A woman who felt burdened to complete each one of these tasks in a day, in a week, or even in a month would be exhausted and probably very discouraged. Yet the character that's poetically described here can be evident in a wise and godly woman's life in its own way. I mean, I could just think of this list being used to almost torment a woman. Hey, Christian wife, today did you seek out any wool and flax? Today did you willingly work with your hands? Today were you like a merchant ship? Today did you bring food to your family from afar? Today did you rise before the sun came up? You know, you could use this list as a whip upon a wife. But that's not the idea at all. This is a poetic and beautiful and really clearly understood description of a godly woman and her character of diligent activity. Now, the flurry of activity that's described in these verses doesn't mean that she does all these things in a day or even in a week, but it does point to how much work and how many different kinds of work are involved in wisely and properly managing a home. Listen, if you think about a woman who wisely and properly manages a home, she's got to know a lot and be diligent in so many areas. Women today can take comfort and confidence that God recognizes right here just how big the job of a woman is in managing the home in a godly and wonderful way. Listen, other people may not recognize how big your job is, but God sees it. He describes it right here in these verses, verses 13 through 16. Now, if you look at that phrase, verse 13, she seeks wool and flax. The virtuous woman knows how to seek and find things that are necessary resources for her family and her home. Verse 13 says that she willingly works with her hands. The virtuous wife is not proud or haughty. She doesn't think that working with her hands is beneath her. She works in simple and in practical ways for the good of her family and her home. And you could say that what sets this virtuous wife apart is that she willingly works. That describes something of the heart, does it not? Adam Clark put it like this: and all her labor is a cheerful service. Her will, her heart is in it. Now that is a blessing to a home. Some people will work out of reluctant necessity and let you know how miserable they are every step of the way. Not this virtuous wife. She willingly works. Then verse 14 says, she's like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. The virtuous wife provides food for her family and home after the pattern of a merchant ship, which operates with regularity and with effort. And if required, verse 15 says, she even rises while it is yet night to either get or to prepare food for her household. Now, if I could say this, if it's not necessary, it's not necessary. But the virtuous woman says, if it's necessary for me to rise before the sun comes up to properly get or prepare food, I will do it. And not only for her immediate household, that is her husband and children, but verse 15 says also a portion for her maidservants. It wasn't uncommon for many families in biblical times to have servants or hired workers. The virtuous wife wisely manages and cares for such maidservants. She shows her compassion and her care even beyond her immediate family. Verse 16 continues by saying that she considers a field and buys it. The virtuous wife is forward thinking. She combines her creativity with her hard work. She thoughtfully, that is, it says she considers a field, she thoughtfully invests and uses the profits to better her family and their future. In this case, she plants a vineyard. By the way, go back to Isaiah chapter 5, starting at verse 2, and look at the description of all that is involved in planting a vineyard in ancient Israel and in making it productive. It was a lot of work, but the virtuous wife, the virtuous woman, she'll do it. She's a woman of enterprise and energy and hard work. But that's not all. Look here, starting at verse 17 all the way through to verse 20. This will describe her strength and compassion. It says this: she girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. The virtuous wife is noted for her strength, and it is strength in action. It's strength in her arms, and she uses that strength for productive purposes. So here's one productive purpose. Verse 18, she perceives that her merchandise is good. She's wise and experienced enough to get good materials and merchandise for her home. Her wisdom teaches her to buy oil for her lamp, and to buy oil of such quality that it burns through the night and does not go out. Adam Clark put it like this. He said, "She takes care to manufacture the best articles of the kind and to lay a reasonable price that she may secure a ready sale. Her goods are in high repute, and she knows that she can sell as much as she can make. And she finds that while she pleases her customers, she increases her own profits." Now, as part of the manufacturing process, verse 19 says, "She stretches out her hands to the distaff." This means that the virtuous wife knows how to use the tools and the technology available to manage the home well. The distaff is a stick or spindle onto which wool or flax is wound for spinning. And she uses both hands to do the work well. By the way, Bruce Waltke pointed out that this work of weaving and creating thread and yarn and such, that Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, these great women among the patriarchs of Israel, they were women of high social standing, yet they were mentioned carrying out this manual, even menial labor. It wasn't like it in ancient Israel, in the biblical culture, that someone was so high and mighty that they never had to work for themselves. No, they did work themselves. But verse 20 also says that she extends her hand to the poor. The virtuous wife is much more than a skillful manager or homemaker. She's also a woman of great compassion. She cares for and she helps both the poor and the needy. She does more than throw money to them, but she actually draws near to them and she extends her hand and reaches out to those who are in need. You see, her hard work was not only for her own needs and the needs of her family, but she also worked to help the poor and the needy. Alan Ross made this comment. He said, "This was the hand that was diligently at work in the previous verse with an acquired skill. It is not the hand of a lazy, wealthy woman. She uses her industry in charitable ways." Now, starting at verse 21, we have a couple verses on God's blessing on the virtuous wife. Here we go, starting at verse 21. "She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land." Notice, she's not afraid of snow for her household. The virtuous wife has the wisdom, diligence, and preparation to prepare her household for all kinds of challenges and adversity. Her fear of the Lord and the wisdom that flows from it invites God's blessing, even being able to clothe all her household in prestigious scarlet. Now, some people wonder why scarlet clothing would be connected to the fact that she's not afraid of snow for her household. It's been suggested that the scarlet color of her clothing makes her children easy to find in heavy snow. But I don't think that's it. Look, in ancient Israel, in the biblical world, if there was snowfall, it was relatively light. A heavy snowfall of many feet or meters, it was not really known in the ancient biblical world or in the modern land of Israel. So I don't think that it's that so they could be found in a snowdrift. But it's possible that a scarlet garment describes not so much a color, but many commentators point to the idea that it describes a doubly thick garment, something that will be warm even in cold weather. Verse 22 also says that she makes a tapestry for herself. With God's blessing on her wisdom and diligence, the virtuous wife makes good things for herself and enjoys personal marks of God's material blessing on her family. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. And what's more, verse 23 says, her husband is known in the gates. The virtuous wife sees such a blessing on her family and household that her husband is also esteemed and honored among the elders of the land, as verse 23 says. You see, all this is the blessing of God that often comes to the wife who walks in the virtue, wisdom, and fear of the Lord. Adam Clark put it like this. She is a loving wife and feels for the respectability and honor of her husband. He is respected not only on account of the neatness and cleanness of his person and dress, but because he is the husband of a woman who is justly held in universal esteem. And her complete management of household affairs gives him full leisure to devote himself to the civil interests of the community. Yes, it's very much due to the wife's godly diligence that her husband is known in the gates among the elders of the land, as verse 23 describes. Now, verses 24 and 25, the clothing that she sells and the clothing that she has, we read here. She makes linen garments and sells them, and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. The wisdom and diligence of the virtuous wife leads her to not only provide the necessities for her family, but she makes enough and of such great quality that she sells those necessities to the sellers, that is, the merchants. She cares deeply for her family, but her mind and her vision goes beyond her family to the outside world, where she also does good for herself and for her family. For the point that, look at this in verse 25, strength and honor are her clothing. The fact that she is willing to distribute and sell linen garments that she makes and has shows that her first priority isn't in what's in her closet or in what she wears. She cares more about the display of her character than the outward display of her clothing. And so when it comes to character, this virtuous wife is one of the best dressed. She's clothed with strength and honor so that she shall rejoice not only in the present day, but also in time to come. Friends, you look at this virtuous wife. I look at her as being so wonderfully fulfilled in my own wife, Inga Lil. And I can say of her, strength and honor are her clothing. Now, make no mistake, my wife is a nice dresser. She knows how to put herself together. But that's not her greatest characteristic. It's the strength and honor that mark her life. And Bruce Waltke put it like this. He said of that phrase, strength and honor, he said, the praise of the woman can hardly be higher. It attributes to her the advantages of both youth and old age. In other words, in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 29, it says, strength belongs to youth and honor belongs to old age. Well, this virtuous wife has them both. She has the best of youth and the best of old age. That's what kind of godly, wonderful woman of character that she is. Verses 26 and 27 describe the inner life of this virtuous woman. Verse 26, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. You see, the description of the woman's inner life continues from the previous verse. The virtuous wife has what is often described and valued in the book of Proverbs, wise speech. She opens her mouth with wisdom. And when she speaks, it's words that show the law of kindness. You see, both her deliberate speech when she opens her mouth and her spontaneous words, that's what's on her tongue. Those words are marked by wisdom and by kindness. Matthew Poole put it like this in his commentary. He said, she is neither sullenly silent nor full of vain and impertinent talk, as many women are, but she speaks directly and piously as the occasion offers itself. That's a good analysis there by Matthew Poole. Verse 27 goes on to say that she watches over the ways of her household. Please note that. As a faithful guardian, the virtuous wife is observant of her family and their ways. The choice to watch so carefully means that she does not choose to eat at the bread of idleness. No, she's active and she's looking out for her family. John Trapp put it like this. She has an oar in every boat, an eye in every business. She spies and pries into her children's and servants' carriages and exacts of them strict conversation and growth in godliness. She overlooks the whole family no otherwise than if she were in a watchtower. In other words, what John Trapp is saying, it's as if she's in a watchtower looking over her family. She examines them. She looks. She knows what's going on. As verse 27 says, she watches over the ways of her household. And then verse 27 also says that she doesn't eat the bread of idleness. That's just sort of an ancient figure of speech or idiom for someone who's lazy. That's not this virtuous wife or woman. Then verses 28 and 29. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. You see, a woman of such character and wisdom rightly receives the blessings and praises of her family. Both her children and her husband not only see, but also speak of the blessedness of the woman who brings such blessing to their household. Friends, this is not only a description of the virtuous wife, but it's also an exhortation to children and to the husband to bless and praise the mother and wife of godly character, that most excellent wife, the virtuous wife. And in a sense, it's easy to do. I can certainly be among those, as a husband, who will rise up and praise his wife for her great godliness, for the way that she matches the character of the woman in this description so wonderfully. I would be among those who would say what's in verse 29. These are the words of the husband. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. You see, these are the words of the husband as he praises his wife, with words that encourage, reward, and nourish her. Now, I want you to think about this. In a completely literal sense, this could only be true of one woman in any given community at any given time. Only one can excel them all. Yet, we perfectly understand the sense of this. It's true, every home can have a wife and a mother that does excel them all. Every husband can legitimately feel, I've got the best wife. All children can legitimately feel, we have the best mom. It's true. Now, in his remarks on this verse, Adam Clark thought of a woman who perhaps truly did excel them all. Maybe you've heard of her, Susanna Wesley. She was the mother of Charles Wesley and John Wesley, those two great men of the 18th century. Anyway, this is what Adam Clark said of Susanna Wesley. But as high as the character of this Jewish matron stands in the preceding description, I can say that I have met at last her equal. the wife of Samuel Wesley and mother of the late extraordinary brothers John and Charles Wesley. I am constrained to add this testimony after having traced her from her birth to her death through all the relations that a woman can bear on earth. Her Christianity gave to her virtues and excellences a heightening which the Jewish matron could not possess. Besides, she was a great woman of great learning and information and of a depth of mind and reach of thought seldom to be found among the daughters of Eve and not often among the sons of Adam. Well, that was a very eloquent statement of praise that Adam Clark had for this woman who had died in his own day, Susanna Wesley. But friends, that excellent wife should hear it from her husband and children. You excel them all. I've got the best wife. We've got the best mom. I hope that many of you have the same privilege that I have in being able to say that freely and honestly as a husband. But I hope that many of you women have the same blessing of being women of that character. Look, we're not talking about throwing out words and flattery, but those who can genuinely hear this wonderful acclamation. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Now, the last two verses of the book of Proverbs, the praise and the reward of the wise woman. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. Again, these are the words of King Lemuel's mother, and she noted the passing nature of outer beauty and the deceitful nature of potentially manipulative charm. In contrast, a woman who fears the Lord has beauty that does not pass, and she has charm that does not deceive. Friends, it's true. Charm can be deceitful. Beauty is passing. Alan Ross said on that phrase, beauty is passing, he said, physical appearance is not necessarily dismissed. It simply does not endure as do those qualities that the fear of the Lord produces. One who pursues beauty may very well be disappointed by the character of the beautiful person. Friends, there's a beauty that goes beyond outward beauty. And listen, I mean, I'm blessed to have a wife who is beautiful in both senses. Yes, she has the outward beauty, and that's a wonderful blessing from the Lord. But friends, even more importantly, she has that beauty of character. Because it is true. Charm is deceitful. Beauty is passing. But what does it say? A woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Now, do you remember very back in the first chapter of the book of Proverbs? There was a link made between wisdom and the fear of the Lord. Here, the book of Proverbs ends describing the virtuous wife as being filled with the wisdom, beauty, and charm that marks a woman who fears the Lord. The fact that she truly fears the Lord shows that this wonderful woman of energy and enterprise described for us here in Proverbs chapter 31, she has a real relationship with God. She's not only a Martha busy with service, but she's also a Mary walking in fear and reverence towards the Lord. The woman who fears the Lord has the wisdom and character of the virtuous wife. I'll speak to all the women who hear this. Are you a woman who fears the Lord? Look, of course, I know all the book of Proverbs bring us back to this idea of time. The fear of the Lord is not only the responsibility of women, but this is addressing women, is it not? dear woman, do you fear the Lord? Or do you fear your peers, your social circle, your family? I could go on and on. There are many things that are possible for people to fear more than the Lord. Your social media feedback. No. It's the woman who fears the Lord who has the wisdom and character of the virtuous wife. And the way that the character is expressed may differ according to one's time and culture. Not many virtuous women today are weaving their own thread or yarn or whatever. But the character itself is universal. God honors the virtuous wife, the woman of wisdom and diligence, and he makes her one of the greatest blessings ever given to humanity. Therefore, it concludes in verse 31, give her the fruit of her hands. The virtuous woman will be rewarded by the God she fears, and she will be rewarded by what she has accomplished for her family and herself as they publicly speak of her godliness and wisdom. As it says there in verse 31, let her own works praise her in the gates. For the woman of wisdom, and we could say the same principle applies to the man of wisdom, but what's in view here is the woman of wisdom. This reward is not their primary motivation to receive the open praise in the gates of the city. It's not the primary motivation, but it is the fitting result of the life they live in the fear of the Lord. Dear brother, if you're not married, I pray that God would help you find such a virtuous woman and use this list as a guide to measure a woman's character. Dear brothers who are married, does your wife know how grateful you are for her? And I know you may say, well, she doesn't match up in this area and that area. Yes, there's no doubt that every woman fails according to this list in some way or another. You fail in an extreme application for the lists in Titus chapter 1 and 1 Timothy chapter 3. Okay, we get that. But is her life lived in that orientation? And where she does succeed in it, do you praise her? Do you honor her? It's appropriate for you to do that. And wives, women, use this as a way to encourage you in faith to continue to walk in the ways of the Lord and to be able to say, I'm growing in the character of a godly, wise woman who truly fears the Lord. All right, as we've done in every chapter, now here at the end of Proverbs chapter 31, let's look at some ways that Proverbs chapter 31 points to Jesus Christ. I'll just give a couple of ways. Number one, in verse 8, it says, open your mouth for the speechless, for the cause of all who are appointed to die. I would say that this verse points to Jesus by way of contrast. No one opened their mouth for Jesus. No one stood for him when he was appointed to die. Friends, where Jesus' associates and disciples and those around him, where they failed him, we should not fail others. And we won't, as God empowers us to do it. But then lastly, let's just think of Jesus as a summary of the entire book of Proverbs. What's Proverbs all about? It's about wisdom. And don't ever forget that Jesus himself is the wisdom of God. Colossians chapter 2, verse 3 says that in Jesus are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 24 says that Jesus Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. And 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 30 says that Jesus became for us wisdom from God. Friends, as we grow in wisdom and the fear of the Lord, we're going to grow in the image of Jesus Christ as we are continually transformed in his image and grow in grace. Let that growth manifest itself in greater wisdom and greater fear of the Lord. Father, as we come now to the end of the book of Proverbs, we thank you. We thank you for the great wisdom that you give us in your word. And we feel burdened because we don't measure up to it. But yet our trust is in a perfectly wise Savior. Our trust is in Jesus Christ, who is for us wisdom and knowledge. So Lord, as we trust in Jesus, as we seek the knowledge and wisdom that comes from your word, and as we choose the path of wisdom, help us to grow. Help us to honor you with lives marked by the fear of the Lord and the wisdom of God. Work this in us, Lord, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for joining us today, everyone. For more information about Enduring Word and Pastor David Guzik, please visit enduringword.com or download our free Enduring Word app.